I'm going to be presenting a large group effort that began here 2 years ago. This is a large cast of characters. We have cryptographers, we have human factors people, we have statistical auditing people, and we have the elections office of a county. A huge number of people have helped contribute to make this happen, and I'm just one of many people. Well, 2 years ago at this conference, Dana DeBeauvoir came here, and she said, I want to build a new thing, and it's going to be great, and you can help me. And Josh was like, I want to help you, and the rest of us jumped in too. So today I'm going to be describing some of the outcome of that effort. First, for those of you who aren't familiar, Travis County, the home of Austin, Texas, the capital of the state, is roughly central, beautiful place to go. You should all visit, enjoy the bars and the live music scene. Roughly 1 million people live in the county. In the last presidential election, just shy of 400,000 voters. Texas has early voting, which is something that is not a universal thing. So there are 23 locations throughout Travis County where any registered voter may go in the 2 weeks prior to the election and cast their ballot. So any voter can go to any early voting center and be given their ballot. And there are variations on this across the state. On election day, Travis County also has vote centers. This was a response to the redrawing of the gerrymandering of the districts. So in order to keep voters from getting confused, they waved a magic wand and said, Shazam, every polling place is now a voting center. Any voter can go to any polling place, and there's lots of them, and then we don't have to worry about voters getting confused about where they're supposed to go vote. It was a great way of avoiding what would have been a huge disaster. Yes, yeah. I live there, and we don't have election day vote centers, but we do have early voting. Okay, so, and in Texas, it's typical in some ballots to have 100 plus questions to the voter. So our elections are complicated. We vote for a large number of judges who are running unopposed. It's great. Why? I don't know. Okay. So Travis County has had a bunch of different voting technologies. Before 2001, they used centrally tabulated optical scan. It was a logistical nightmare of managing all these ballots coming back to one place. And then they jumped on the electronic voting bandwagon in 2001. They were one of the first in the state to adopt this device, a Hart Intercivic eSlate. It's got a little iPod wheel that you scroll to pick what you want, and it's locally networked in the polling place, so that there are no, they don't have the smart cards that Diebold has, which turned out to be a huge security threat vector. Okay, first, the marketing pitch. No ambiguity of voter intent, which is great, because when you look at hand-marked ballots, you get ambiguous intent. There are a variety of accessibility features. They have a headphone jack that works all the time, so it's not like there's accessibility mode and regular mode. It's just talking all the time. Whatever you highlight with the cursor, it's reading. I did it once for fun. You know, I just put the headphones on while I was voting. It works. They get fast results at the end of the day, and they piss off all the election activists. But who cares about them? Around 2011, Dana and her team said, you know what? It's time for something new. And there was nothing on the market that they liked. All the technologies that were for sale weren't really any better. And certainly the world must have gotten better. Hey, maybe I'll call in those academics, right? So Dana calls me and says, Dan, I want you to organize a thing. And I'm like, you're pulling my leg. She's like, no, really. We're gonna do this. I'm like, well, can I invite a whole bunch of people and let's have a big meeting in Austin? She's like, we can do that. I'm like, all right then. So I invited a bunch of people. Now, you know, Josh was so excited. He's like, I'm going to take vacation time from Microsoft and come down on my own. This is great. I'm like, well, I want this guy Olivier because he's been doing all this cool work. And they're like, well, we can't afford to fly him in from Belgium. Olivier came on his own dime, right? This is such a rare opportunity that we all jumped on it. So we spent a long weekend discovering the joys of eating dried apricots and wasabi peas. And we came up with a design. So I'm going to be telling you today about that design. But first, some of the constraints that led to the design. Constraint number one, it must have a DRE-style user interface. I've been calling this the DRE experience. Sounds like a ride at Disney. Not a very popular one. So we want to have all the accessibility features that you can get in a DRE-style experience, where you can just plug in a headphone and it can tell you what's going on. That's really essential. Likewise, if you have low vision, we can have big text, et cetera. If you're not a native English speaker, we can change it to be another language. We want the kind of accessibility features that you can really only do well when you've got a computer interface, not paper. And it's essential that we can disambiguate voter intent before they leave the polling place. Way, way too many problems happen when you have paper. We don't want to have any lizard people issues. For those of you who haven't seen it, anyway, okay. We want to use off-the-shelf hardware because those e-slates are thousands of dollars, and that's crazy. This thing, just to pick an example, Sony will sell you a 20-inch touchscreen. It's a computer, it has a hard drive, it has a battery, and it's like $1,000. Why can't I use that? Right? And oh, by the way, then you get to buy a support contract from Sony rather than from Hardin or Civic or ES&S or whatever. So it's cheaper to buy, cheaper to maintain. And you know, I don't know if this is our proposed voting UI or not, but you have a lot of flexibility for how you want to do the UI. We can have a huge screen. Think about the possibilities for low vision voters. Now we can really give them big text if that's what our user interface people say that we need. We're going to have a printer. This is one of the upfront constraints. There shall be printed paper ballots. And so we're going to have machine printed paper going into a ballot box. So let me. 1-to-1. So the paper ballots, we want to have tangible physical things that a voter can look at and say, yup. Now, never mind that we have human factors results that say half the voters won't notice if we flip their vote, and they'll still love the experience. Nonetheless, the other half might notice errors. So that's something. And the design of this is that we only show them their selections, just like the summary screen on a traditional DRE. This allows us to fit that huge number of candidates on one or at most two sheets of paper. Right now, we're thinking we'll use US legal size, 8.5 by 14. That's the rough idea. So this is a mock-up of the ballot using Microsoft Excel. The final ballot will almost certainly look a fair bit different. But you know, there'll be a barcode that indicates like your precinct number and some other and some like a random nonce or other data that we need for cryptographic purposes. Now, the Californians in the room will say, but you're not allowed to have numbers printed on the ballot. Well, the Texas state constitution says ballots shall be numbered. So we're good. Now, don't ask me how lever machines were legal to use in Texas when those same lever machines have no possible concept of numbering the ballots. My understanding is the lawyer said, well, ballots shall be numbered means there must be some kind of security mechanism. I don't know. I'm not a lawyer. All right. Constraint number three. Travis County digs this whole vote center thing. So we need to keep the vote center idea, where any voter can go to any polling place and have their ballot delivered to them in person, which means that we're going to have an online voter registration database to prevent somebody from voting often, or more often than allowed. The voting machines themselves we want to be offline. So that way, there's no way, you know, the internet can't get to the voting machines at all. And you know, to the extent that data flows, we're going to be very, very careful about how data flows in anywhere, any place involving the internet. We have thousands of distinct ballot styles because of the carefully complicated overlapping gerrymandered districts. So the notion of pre-printing ballots is simply untenable. We cannot pre-print thousands of distinct ballot styles and have them in every possible precinct. Can you imagine what a nightmare that would be? It's not going to happen. Constraint number four, the show must go on, even if we lose power for the whole day. That's a really deep constraint, right? We want to be able to get 12 hours on a battery. So Dave's brand new MacBook Air with Intel's latest Haswell processor will get, what, 9-10 hours? If you're lucky. That Sony Vaio Tap 20 I mentioned earlier will get about 4 hours if you turn the screen down to dim. So off-the-shelf hardware is close. My take on this is, if you can do 4 hours on a battery, that's more than enough time for somebody to drive over with a truck that has a Honda gas generator in the back and string an extension cord. So I think we can make this work. Printers have to be thermal. What? No. Yes. Because I want a laser printer. I'm sorry, laser printers take too much power. You know, a laser printer is like a hairdryer. It's like 1,000+ watts to heat up that drum. Can't do that on a battery. Inkjet, no. How many of you hate your inkjet printer? Yeah. Yeah, except that they're wildly unreliable. They clog.
There are some states in which inkjet is not legal for legal documents.
Yeah, and oh, by the way, if you get an inkjet printed anything wet, the ink runs everywhere. Well, so right now we're thinking thermal because it's low power and it's high reliability. All the consumables are in the paper. There's no ink cartridge to replace. There's nothing to clog. Oh yeah, and these things are like stupid small. All right. So right now, are we going to end up using something like a giant 20-inch tablet, or are we going to end up using something more like a laptop? Hard to say. Certainly, there's a whole new generation of laptops being engineered with Windows 8 in mind, which means that they have a flip around. They can be a full touchscreen. So there's a lot. Thank you, Microsoft, for Windows 8. Now we have a large diversity of boxes that have touchscreens that we can buy. So we want to do a lot of sophisticated new stuff. We want to borrow some ideas from an earlier project of mine called VoteBox. So there will be a local network in the polling place, which connects all the machines together, not to the internet, but a local network, wires, not wireless. So this means that we'll, you know, just like here in this room, you see there are wires running to the projector and they're taped down to the floor. We'll do something like that. VoteBox used hash chaining and replication. So if 9 out of 10 machines blew up, you lose nothing. And the hash chains give you a huge amount of ability to solve some of Dave's concerns about, I don't trust my public bulletin board. Because any one record includes the hash of all the previous ones. We're going to use end-to-end cryptography in all of its glory. We're going to have homomorphic verifiable tallies. Thankfully, we don't have to do single transferable vote. And the public bulletin board will have either the full ciphertexts, or perhaps we're going to get into some cool pairing-based crypto that will post summaries that don't violate voter privacy, even if the encryption scheme is broken. Maybe. But you can put a lot of sophisticated crypto here. And we're also going to use evidence-based election techniques. We're going to use risk-limiting audits to make sure that all that paper that's generated corresponds to those electronic records. You don't trust the computer? Great. We're going to statistically verify that the paper matches it. And usability is a big part of the design from the beginning. One of the nice things about having all the machines connected together, for example, is that there is a controller machine that can see all the voting machines. And if let's say the power gets knocked out on some voting machine, it says, oops, I'm on battery, it can send a message to the poll worker. It says, hey, machine number 3 is on battery. Go plug it in. These kinds of things can radically improve usability for the poll workers who aren't trained or don't have the repeat experience. Instead, the machine can tell them, oh, look, you need to do something. Oh, look, here's something going on. This will really help. And it also is going to improve our security. Right. So here's the basic workflow. Here's our registration machine connected to the internet, not to anything inside the polling place. A voter walks up and says, "Hi there, I'd like to vote." So they, in Texas, apparently our governor says that you'll be required to show your driver's license now. Yay. And then we're going to give you a very simple token that just encodes your precinct. That's it. Then you will walk over. So you'll. The token is a piece of thermally printed paper from a restaurant grade, you know, receipt printer. It's going to look exactly like that. Then you'll walk over. So now you're actually entering the voting system. What keeps you from double voting? Well, you can't enter this queue unless you're approved from that queue. Okay? So now you walk over to the controller. The controller will zap that with a barcode reader, avoiding data entry errors. And this will print out some new 5-digit code, which is similar to what Hardiner Civic already does. Again, thermal paper, crumple it up and throw it away when you're done. This is a nonce that allows you to vote and will make sure that you see your proper ballot style. So the voter walks over to the machine, they enter the enter that nonce, and this is, at this point, it's not active anymore. So the lifetime, you don't need to have a, this doesn't need to be 100 digits, because this is only valid from the time you walk from here to here, and then it's gone. So there's a small number of these valid at any given time. If you sit there and just start demon dialing whatever, then you'll steal somebody else's, and they'll be like, "Hey, I can't vote." That would be a detectable failure. I think we will have these be non-repeating, but I don't think it matters. Anyway, now the voter can vote. So they get the DRE experience, they enter their choices, select who they want to vote for, and then it prints out this ballot summary. The voter has it in their hands, and the voter can take it to a ballot box and put it in. Now, the ballot box is on the network. So that means that the ballot box will say, "Hey, I saw this ballot," which then helps the controller say, "Okay, that ballot's been deposited." So we have sort of inventory control, as it were. So this, by having a networked ballot box, a lot of really nice things happen. You know, now we get to track the ballot as it's moving through the system. If it gets deposited, we know that. And here's the cool part. The voter can spoil the ballot, start over. So if the user says, "Whoops, that's not how I wanted to vote," the vote isn't real until the paper goes in the box. And the ballot box has no user interface at all. It just accepts it and puts it in. Now, we are thinking that the ballot box will say, "Hey, I've got ballot ID number blah. Is that an actual valid ballot?" And that way, if you tried to do ballot box stuffing, it would say, "Whoops, that's not right." Or, you know, if the voter is just trying to stick random things in the ballot box, it can reject it. But the ballot box we're not going to have a bottleneck at the ballot box where current precinct-based optical scanners that want to help the voter verify their paper have a UI over here, and then you get a bottleneck of people waiting for the ballot box. All of that happens up here instead. So we're going to catch the machine if it cheats. This is the standard end-to-end thing that Josh presented here many, many years ago. So the voter makes their selection. The voting machine commits to the encryption of their vote, can't take it back. And then the voter is given a choice. The voter can cast the vote, and there's a confirmation of some kind, or the voter can challenge the vote, and then the machine has to prove that their encryption was correct. So in every previous system that has implemented the Benelow challenge, we have to ask the voter a question. I mean, there's a million different ways of encoding the commitment. You know, VoteBox did it by sending a message on the network. Josh's original idea, he printed it on a piece of paper behind an opaque plate. Wow, excuse me. Now I can wake you up. You know, the Helios idea would send you the hash in the web. all of these, asking the voter this question makes usability people sad. Never mind making voters sad. And we saw in the previous talk that they engineered the question out because they didn't want to confuse voters. Well, the cool idea in STAR is that we get rid of that question. Instead, the physical act of putting the paper in the box is that question. So if you put the paper in the box, you've said, please count this vote. If you don't put the paper in the box, then you've said, this is a challenge ballot. So the regular process of a voter choosing to spoil a ballot or cast a ballot now is overloaded with cryptographic meaning, which is cool. So voters who just detect errors are unwittingly helping challenge the system. That's great. And the challenger will get to, if you spoil it, then you can get to take it home. So this is a huge, massive usability win. Also, every voter gets to take home something that looks kind of like that. This is the mock-up du jour. This will change 10 times between now and the final. But the broad idea is you print out a sheet of paper that says, thank you for voting, and it has a URL, both human readable and easily scanned with your phone. This QR code just encodes that URL. And that URL has a hash. What's that hash? That hash covers the ballot ciphertext. So rather than trying to shove the entire encrypted ballot onto here, which would be really big, instead, we give you enough that you can download it later from the public bulletin board and make sure that it's correct. You download your encrypted ballot. But your encrypted ballot doesn't let you tell anything to anybody else. It's only when you challenge it. If you challenge the ballot, then it's not going to be counted. So then you can get your plain text from the bulletin board. What good is it to get your downloaded encrypted ballot later? Well, I'm gonna go into some of the end-to-end properties later. But broadly speaking, it lets you verify that the encrypted ballot is consistent with this thing and is also consistent with the final public tally. More on that coming in a minute. So, an outline of all the different crypto that we're using. Every machine has a public key for signing all of its messages. Every message that is sent by a machine on the local network is signed. That means that the election officials are effectively a certificate authority. So that way, all the machines are blessed by the election official within that specific election. Every message is signed, broadcast, and logged. So every single network message, there's a copy of it on every single machine. The only network primitive available to these machines is a broadcast. This is wildly inefficient, but so what? This is the glory of, you know, the computers are big, fast, and cheap. We're using an n squared gossip algorithm for broadcasting things, and we don't care, because n is so small. Every ballot is a series of exponential Elgamal counters encrypted with the public key of the election official. So we get to do regular, good old-fashioned homomorphic vote tallying with a fairly off-the-shelf kludge for dealing with write-ins. Basically, there's another counter for the write-ins. And then if the write-in counter is one, you go look on the side for the actual text. It's a pain, but anyway. Every counter also includes a NISIC proof that it's zero or one. So that means any election observer can look at every counter on every ballot and make sure that the number that's encrypted is either a zero or a one without being able to tell which. So you can't encrypt the value a million. I really want to vote for this candidate. Probably going to end up specifying some kind of threshold cryptography, you know, some of these K of N schemes for the actual election official's private key, such that an evil election official can't just sneak into a closet and decrypt individual ballots. They can only decrypt the election totals, which they would do with a bunch of election trustees who would come together for that one purpose, and they'd all leave with their key shares. So, what are the properties that this crypto gives us? For the ballots that are challenged, you get to match them up to the plain text by finding your plain text on the public bulletin board. Any ballot, you can verify that it's there on the board. the homomorphic tallying, you can verify that your ballot is part of the public tally, even if you can't prove to a third party how you voted. And you can also verify the hash chains to make sure that not just your ballot is correct, but all the other ballots, at least from your own precinct, are consistent with your hash. So if you vote later in the day, you actually have more verification power over your over the local precinct in which you voted. That's a feature.
You mean the precinct geographically where the person voted, or administratively the logical precinct of all the voters?
I mean the physical location.
Physical location,
sorry. So how are you going to do this verification? The easy thing is you just type the URL into your browser, and now it takes you to the election official's computer, which goes, thumbs up, verifies. That might not be very satisfying. So of course, you can take that hash and download all of the ciphertext yourself. And you might have some open source tool or build your own tool if you're Josh. And then you can verify what you're doing. The alternative that I expect is most, you know, but of course, you know, what happens if we're feeding evil, you know, what if we're just behaving correctly for Josh? I had to borrow that, I'm sorry, it was a moral imperative. So the alternative, the thing that I think is going to actually be the way verification works is that voters aren't going to do this themselves. Voters will delegate verification to an organization that they trust. That could be their political party, that could be a newspaper, that could be the League of Women Voters. That you'll have the League of Women Voters app on your phone, you'll scan that QR code, and it'll say, thanks. And at that point, the League of Women Voters now has hundreds or thousands of hashes pointing into the public bulletin board to help them verify the integrity of the public bulletin board. I think that would be really cool. But what if something goes wrong? Right? You know, this crypto is really, really great at telling us that the results are absolutely perfectly correct and consistent with all the data. But what if they're not? What if we do the homomorphic tallying and it comes up with some nonsense thing? You know, Britney Spears for president. So what now what? Well, we have all of that paper. And the paper should hopefully give us a more accurate representation of the voter's intent. And certainly, if something went horribly awry on the computer side, hopefully things didn't go as far awry in the paper side. So we're going to specify a process to happen after every election. I'm not sure yet whether this would happen during the canvassing period or as a post-election thing. But anyway, the process is that we will randomly sample ballots, paper ballots, and then we will compare them to the electronic records, and they had better match up. This does require being able to decrypt individual ballots, but only the ballots under audit. And you might have to touch tens or hundreds of pieces of paper, but not more. The way SOBA works, as the margin of victory gets tighter, the size of the audit set grows, and in the limit, it degenerates into a full hand recount. So how are we going to do this? The version one that we spec'd out was that we'd do a re-encryption mixnet to a special auditor key, and then the auditor would be able to decrypt things. We didn't like that. Version two in progress, we're going to get rid of the mixnet, and we're going to have codes, kind of like the codes Dave was showing, and exactly how that's going to work, we're actively arguing about. Right. So, 10 minutes. Threat mitigation. Now I'm going to run you through a whole variety of threats and how STAR deals with them. So, the little red horns means it's evil. Right. So let's pretend that we have an evil voting machine that's trying to forge votes. It's just trying to create votes out of thin air. Well, because there are no matching authorizations generated by the controller, you know, hey, I've got a voter here ready to vote on a particular ballot style, then these things will stand out as, here's a logged ballot that doesn't have a corresponding authorization, must be bogus. So these are trivial to detect. Likewise, there won't be a matching paper ballot. So this would show up in the SOBA audit as well. Now let's pretend that we have a controller in cahoots with a voting machine. So I authorize you to vote. Why, thank you, I vote. I authorize you to vote. Why, thank you, I vote. right? We could imagine, so now we can start generating ballots that look great on the electronic side, but once again, we don't have the corresponding paper. And, oh, by the way, we're going to end up with way more votes cast than voters signed in at the polling place. So the mitigation, well, several mitigations. If we arrange for these machines to take different paths back to home base, we can find that, we can actually detect the electronic inconsistencies. And again, we've got the paper, which would give us yet another path for detecting and correcting what went on. What if you can break into the machine and stuff it full of paper, right? Well, at that point, now we've got a whole bunch of paper votes without corresponding electronic votes. So again, there's an inconsistency. You'd do the audit of the paper and you'd say, here's a ballot. Hey, that ballot doesn't exist over here. Related, there's a thing called chain voting. What's to say that I vote on the machine, I take my printout, and I stiff it into my coat, I walk outside, and then the shady character says, give me your ballot, and hands me another one, and says, you know, a chain voting attack, you know, where I cast a previous person's ballot, and the subsequent person casts my ballot, is a traditional attack against all kinds of voting systems. We've thought about chain voting here. The best that we can come up with to mitigate the attack is by timestamping. If I know that a ballot leaves at a ballot was printed at a certain time and cast at a certain time, I can try to put a time bound on that. As long as there's a queue of any length, it takes time for a ballot to go out and all the way back in again. So that's, I expect that the path from here to here is, you know, 1 minute, maybe 2 minutes, but not more. This is a mitigation. It doesn't defeat the attack, but it makes it harder. So what if I have a malicious machine that's trying to, you vote for Alice, it records a vote for Bob, right? Now we'll have a paper ballot that's inconsistent with a ciphertext. So that's something that we can detect through the post-election audit. And likewise, the Benelow challenge mechanism can detect it. So we have complementary and orthogonal mechanisms that can both detect these integrity attacks. What about a privacy attack? Now, this is a machine that simply records the votes in plain text in the order cast off on the side, right? This is a fundamental problem with any kind of cryptographic voting system. There's something ironic that crypto is better at protecting integrity than privacy. Anyway, that's sort of a philosophical question, perhaps. The tentative solution that we've come up with is to apply some kind of TPM, Trusted Platform Management, that would allow that. You know, if you tamper with the software, the machine refuses to boot. This turns out, I thought that Windows 8 had a whole managed boot thing that would solve our problem, and it turns out it does not solve our problem. So I'm not sure how to exactly make TPMs work for us, but I think that this is an interesting challenge, and I think it can be made to work eventually. It's just not going to be like, write 3 lines of code and you're done. It's harder than that. What if we have a malicious ballot box that simply like doesn't acknowledge ballots? I mean, it degenerates into a denial of service attack. This would be observable by poll workers and correctable on the fly. And of course, in a worst case fallback, you know, collect the ballot papers in a cardboard box and hand deal with them later. So the only thing a malicious ballot box can do is break. So that's, again, we can mitigate that through procedures. Can we coerce the voters with randomness? John Kelsey had a great talk where he went through all of these cryptographic voting schemes and showed how they could become self-coercing. Basically, you know, look at that last digit. Is it even or odd? If it's even, you should cast your vote. If it's odd, you should challenge your vote. There are a million variations on this theme. Of course, we can imagine voters deliberately spoiling their ballot many times, you know, oops, until they get one that satisfies the coercer. But we also talked about stronger mitigations. And the problem is, like, you know, I could get rid of the text and just have the barcode. It's incredibly difficult for someone to say, look for the bit that's there in the bottom corner, you know. Once you get older, a certain age, your ability to resolve fine detail on paper is gone. Anyway, if you try to mitigate too strongly against this sort of attack, you end up damaging usability. So right now we're thinking that we're not going to try too hard to mitigate this attack. But if we had to, if this became an actual threat in practice, rather, if it went from a threat to a known vulnerability, then there are steps we could take, such as ditching the printable version. I don't like that, but it's what we'd have to do. One last possible attack. What if the voter presents a fake receipt? Here's my receipt. The ballot's not on the public bulletin board. I've been disenfranchised. Hooey. The only way, so we're thinking that's a real problem. We don't want somebody to be able to call the whole election into question and cause a whole lot of people to start running around trying to figure out what happened. So we're imagining that the physical paper can be watermarked. We've talked to the people who make thermal paper, and they're like, oh, watermarking? Yeah, we can do that. So maybe that's printed on the back, I'm not sure. Likewise, the QR code can be digitally signed by the voting machine. So that makes this get to be a denser QR code. But with a digital signature, that's something where a forgery becomes digitally hard to do. Of course, then they might say, oh, the machine printed it that way. Well, you know, did it print any other ones that had a, we could go through the ballot box and verify the signature on everything. And if only one of them has a bogus, you know, if voter equals not Fenella, whatever. You can imagine that we should be able to detect bogus signatures. Likewise, you can imagine that for challenge ballots, somebody could try to forge those. My vision for the challenge ballot scenario, where you're spoiling a ballot, is that poll workers take a big red stamp that says spoiled, and then the poll workers physically sign it in ink. And at that point, you have a physical record with, you know, traditional physical signatures on it, which is a lot harder for somebody to forge. So where are we? I had this summer two undergrads and two high school kids taking the original vote box source code, which didn't have any kind of printing, and they've beaten it up to the point that it looks a lot like Star now. The specs that we're working on call for the VVSG 2007 user interface. We haven't done any of that yet. This is just a proof of concept. If you were going to build a production voting system, I hope you could do better than two undergrads and two high school kids. So you'd probably best start from scratch. But our proof of concept should be really helpful. The gory details of the design, we're about to launch a request for proposals, which is to say somebody can bid to actually build something for us, and we've got like a 100-page document detailing precisely all the little things that we expect to be. This shall be done, this may be done, this won't be done, etc. Briefly, I want to talk about some of the legalities here. This thing is nothing like any normal voting system that's ever been certified for voting ever in the US. It's totally different. Like, among other problems, what's a ballot? There are lots of copies. And no one copy is the canonical, correct measure of the voter's intent. So depending on what fails, depending on the forensics that we figure out, oh, it looks like somebody tampered with this, that makes that a better record. I don't think that I can canonically say that the piece of paper wins or the digital wins. The answer is it depends on what we think went wrong. Likewise, what's a recount? We have all kinds of evidence of voter intent. So we can imagine a variety of different procedures that are either statistical audits or full digital recounts or full manual recounts or some various combinations thereof. So we're going to have to invent several different recount procedures. And maybe we'll offer them to the candidates as a menu of choices, since candidates typically pay the expenses of a recount. So is that true in Travis County? Yeah. Candidates, you want a recount? Great, pay up. Well, we can give them a menu of options, and they can pay more for different things. We've had to worry about a bunch of annoying practical details, like we have to do provisional voting. So we're imagining there's sort of a web user interface where you can say, here's my name, here's my address, here's why I should be allowed to vote, even though you think I'm not. At that point, the paper ballot goes into an envelope rather than into the ballot box. There's a thing called a limited ballot. I hadn't heard of this before. This is when a voter moves into the county after the registration deadline, but before the election. This is one of these weird corner cases. So the law says that they're allowed to see, they're allowed to vote on the candidates that are in the intersection of their old ballot and their new ballot. So the logic, if it's in the old ballot and it's in the new ballot, then you can still vote for it. So this is a special procedure that we'll have to deal with. And then, of course, we have to deal with write-in votes. My big question about write-in votes, in Texas, you have to register in advance as a write-in candidate or else it doesn't count. So that means, hypothetically, we know who all the write-in candidates are, so maybe we can offer autocomplete. Or, you know, rather than having to record somebody's actual write-in, maybe we can say, oh, did you mean you wanted to vote for, or maybe even give them a pop-up menu. As a security person, that sounds great. But explain that to a politician, I imagine their heads will explode. So I'm not sure whether we can get away with that. All right, I'm eating into lunchtime. So how could we make Dave Wagner happy? Well, if you had standard formats, and if we could ship a ballot definition anywhere, then maybe you could set up a star vote precinct in a remote consulate or embassy or military base. And we could digitally move electronic records around, and then we could send all the paper ballots via courier. And the cool part about this is that now you get better mixing. Because if everybody's voting on star, then the remote votes mix in with the local votes and your anonymity sets are bigger. So remote voting is not internet voting. I think star could be a great way of doing remote voting. Lastly, let's pretend that you're Los Angeles County and you want to have paper ballots rather than electronic ballots. What you could do is you could actually have fewer voting terminals and instead have a scanner built into the voting terminals. So I could mark the paper either in a voting booth or even in a pre-voting scenario. I could mark the paper before I even show up, then scan it in, and then I have the UI to help me correct my ballot. You know, so if my spouse tried to coerce me to vote a certain way, I can take that pre-marked ballot, scan it in, and then fix it in the comfort and privacy of the booth. And then it prints out a regular star vote ballot that goes in the ballot box, et cetera. Same back-end processing as before. Right. Procedurally, if this works for Travis County, it should be able to work elsewhere as well. There's nothing magic about Travis County to this design. So I could imagine other counties pitching in. Turns out, like, a whole bunch of Southern California counties already have a consortium to deal with digital records management. You know, counties have to deal with birth records, death records, deeds to the title for your house and your car. All that crap is county records. So they already have shared infrastructure and shared consortia for managing software. I think Texas counties have something similar for judicial records. Yeah. So this is actually not a crazy thing. Counties already know how to play with each other for shared software infrastructure. So this could work. And you could imagine that even we want this to be open source software owned by the county. And of course, vendors can resell hardware. Vendors can offer training and support contracts. There's a world here for vendors, you know, ESNS, Hardiner, Civic, et cetera, to still exist and still make money. So wrapping things up, because we're eating into our lunchtime. StarVote, it's happening. It's end-to-end. It's risk-limiting audits. It's got a public bulletin board structure that I think has a lot of lovely redundancy that could work. And usability features and accessibility features, off-the-shelf hardware, open-source software. It's happening. Thank you very much. So I'd love to take some of your questions, but we're also eating into lunch. So why don't we keep a couple questions quick, and then let's go eat.
OK, just a quick hardware question. I think cost is still a concern, $1,000 per terminal. But I was just wondering this. Could you have something like $1,000 computer, and then a bunch of USB connected screens that cost $50 each that you could, you know, plus a printer at each place, but you could have, so you could have a cheap screen and a cheap printer and somehow connect them to a central computer, which doesn't have to be that fancy. Maybe that could save money.
The most expensive component is the big, beautiful touchscreen.
And maybe you don't need a really big one. I mean, I'm just saying, suppose you had one, you know, and you could magnify the letters on it. I'm just trying to think of ways that you could, because you really need a lot of these to make sure you don't have long lines. That's the
right.
concern.
I think that the downward pricing pressure in the commercial market is our friend. You know, it's already, you know, maybe the answer is we want to run this off of Android tablets that cost $200-$300 rather than this big thing that costs $1,000. At that point, you give up on having an Ethernet jack and lots of USB ports. But we're like a third of the price of an off-the-shelf voting machine. Still too much, but a huge improvement. And when these wear out, you know, 5 years from now, you tell me what a 20-inch touchscreen computer is going to cost. All I can say is less. Right, but I mean, roughly speaking, in terms of budgeting, I mean, these are very rough numbers. Roughly $4 million to pay some people to build the software, and then another $4 million to buy a bunch of computers. So, you know, if you drive the hardware cost down, there's still this one-time software cost. So.
And don't you lose your redundancy in that way, too?
Right. Right now, there's enough, I mean, elections cost money. You know, if you want to do a paper election, you have to print all these paper ballots, and in a big area, that can be six figures just to print all the paper. All right. Other questions, or shall we go eat? All right, bug me later. Let's go have lunch. Thank you very much.